like titles and the best live author events. Visit us at 296 Walnut Street in Newton, or online at www.newtonbooks.com. Welcome to the Boston Globe Newtonville Books Great Writers Podcast. Here's Tim Huggins, the owner of Newtonville Books, introducing a recent event from the store's Books and Birds authors.
My name is Tim Huggins. I'm the owner of Newtonville Books, and it's a real honor to have Tony Khan here tonight. As many of you know, he directs and produces Morning Stories for WGBH, and if you're living under a rock, WGBH is sort of the listener-supported radio station that has been producing great music, shows, and arts in Boston for over 50 years. It's a great honor to have him here, and just please help me welcome Tony.
For a man to refer to a local Boston public radio station and say GBH rather than BUR is a sign of enormous focus, Tim. I can't tell you how impressed I am. In the interest of time, because I know we don't have that much of it, I'm going to be very brief, and I told Jay that in order to make it brief, I would have to cut down the list of his credits. And we can probably save 3 or 4 minutes right there. Like many of you, and perhaps all of you, I'm a loyal listener to the This I Believe series on NPR. And for far more years than that's been going on, pretty much since the dawn of public radio, it's also been my pleasure and my privilege to count Jay Allison as a colleague and a fellow producer. Now, I will not list all of the credits, but for those of you who are not familiar with any of them other than the This I Believe series, they kind of go on and on and on like columns in the Parthenon of NPR. This you got Lost and Found Sound, Hidden Kitchens, the Sonic Memorial Project, which is to honor, if that's the right word, the aftermath of 9/11. He's also been involved in the creation of Atlantic Public Media, public radio stations for Cape Cod, Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, WCAI, and WNAN, and also two main forums that support and give opportunities to be heard to independent radio producers, Transom.org and the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. As for major awards, well, his Peabody's alone take up all of the fingers on this hand, and the rest of them, well, I don't have enough digits left to count them. But I think the most significant thing, the thing that impresses me the most about Jay, is that he's a master of radio's finest art, I believe, and that's finding and shaping the sound of individual human voices with an unforgettable story to tell. Our fellow human beings on this planet whose personal experiences are told so well that they really become part of our own experience, kind of help shed a little light on what it means to be a human being on this world and in these times. As you probably know, any of you who have listened for any amount of time to National Public Radio, and I assume that includes a few of you here, there are two mighty streams of programming that issue forth from NPR and that have for over 30 years. On the one hand, you've got the hard news that you can trust, and you have the personal stories that you can't forget. The first, you might say, tries to catch a picture of the events that divide us and that threaten us. And the second group of programming tries to do maybe the opposite, to catch a picture of the significant experiences and convictions that we share as individual human beings. Nowadays, hard news absorbs most of NPR's energies and really commands its budget, but it's the personal stuff that keeps us welded to the steering wheels of our cars and in touch with some of the deepest parts in ourselves. And Jay and his crew of collaborators have created more of these so-called driveway moments than anybody else that I know. And I should add a driveway moment with a kitchen component, not just because the Kitchen Sisters are involved in many of Jay's projects, But because as soon as you hear the story in a driveway moment, the first thing you want to do is tell it to somebody else when you get into the kitchen. And it's that marvelous, infectious quality of stories that treat human beings like a vector, that they're the virus and we're their means of transmitting themselves around the world, is what's so compelling about Jay's work and about the best in public radio. Anyway, Jay's most recent venture into the world of books is why we're here tonight. And it's appropriate because we are in the midst of an era of mixing media like we have never been before. Radio and writing certainly have a lot in common, a love of words and well-wrought sentences, books on tape. In fact, Mr. Lightman I know very well, mostly by hearing him, not by reading him. But the most important thing that writing and radio have in common for us tonight is Jay Allison, who is going to be bringing us, I'm sure, an evening that it will be very hard to forget. So, ladies and gentlemen, Jay Allison.
Yeah. I wish there was more room. It's so nice to see you all out here. Tony, thank you so much for that kind and overgenerous introduction. I think you'll be glad you came tonight because we have an embarrassment of essayists here, and they're so good. And I'm meeting some of them for the first time. I've talked to them all on the phone, and have seen their photographs. We have our photographer here. I want to take a few minutes to introduce some of the people who've helped make this. I also want to say what Tony said about this notion of maybe the news talks about what divides us or frightens us, and that series like this does the opposite. I think that says it just about perfectly. When my collaborator, Dan Gediman, who's not here because he was wrestling with his kids and they tore his cartilage, but his parents are here. Yeah. Oh, and they're injured too. Yeah. But he was homesick again several years ago and pulled a book out of his wife's bookshelf called This I Believe, and it was put the way it's designated there is it's written for Edward R. Murrow, and it was 100 essays from the 1950s, maybe 20 of which are also included in this book from people like Leonard Bernstein and Eleanor Roosevelt, Helen Keller, Martha Graham, arranged alphabetically, shoulder to shoulder, with 80 essayists from today, people you've heard of, Gloria Steinem, Colin Powell, John Updike, William F. Buckley, and people perhaps you've not heard of who are eloquent and remarkable, as our subtitle suggests. Dan pulled the book down and called me and said, the time is right to bring this back. It's about 50 years to the day when that series went off the air. They were on the air every single day for 5 years doing this series. And so we did all the things you have to do in public radio, which is mainly raise money, and to bring this back because we felt we were divided fundamentally in the same way that they were in Murrow's age, that we were afraid. We were afraid of the other. We were afraid of our neighbors. And that one way to counter that would be to listen. And, all my work is about having the stories of others in some way become your stories. And on our radio station down on Cape Cod, we do the whole day is broken up with tiny little stories that air in 60-second bursts from all the people who live there. They just come on unheralded, and you hear the voice of somebody you've never met but lives near you. And in a way, it kind of brings you together. We have two islands that don't like each other just because, people tend to be tribal and enjoy the opportunity to not like one another. So Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket have this attitude about one another. But when on our radio station you hear the voice, the eloquent, charming, funny voice of somebody, and then later you realize at the end of this 60-second break they don't come from your island, then you have to reconcile that fact. And I think this series is is doing that too. You may hear an essay from Gloria Steinem and you may have fundamental disagreement with her, or from Newt Gingrich. But when you hear it, what it is that drives their personal life, when you hear their experience, when you hear the story from which their belief derives, they become another human being. And then their story in some way becomes your story. This series at its heart is an invitation. I'll read a little bit from my introduction in a second. But I want to introduce somebody who helped us get this going. And just so you can see, he's here. He's a wonderful man and helped us bring this into being and take on the legacy of this remarkable series that aired in the 1950s. And that's Casey Murrow, Edward R. Murrow's son.
It's not fair that I get this microphone before the essayist, because I haven't written one of these essays. I would like to simply add to the comments that Jay has made that the original version of this, I believe, was a tremendous success and a tremendous sense of satisfaction for the people who worked on it. It was a nonprofit project and a for-profit commercial network, and it brought voices of so many people alive on the radio at a time of some turmoil in our country, at least in some people's lives. And I thought it was history. It was a very interesting bit of history, but it was certainly history until Dan and Jay and others got together to create this new version. And this new version of this, I believe, the book and the radio broadcasts, is such a tribute to their work and I think to the people who've written these new essays, as well as to a lot of the folks who are reprinted who wrote in the earliest series. A great opportunity for all of us to take a look at some old things and some new things and see how they fit together in the way we think about the world. So thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Casey. So since we went on the air about a year and a half ago, and we went on not knowing really what the reaction would be, and we had the sense that people would respond to this and that they would want to have this kind of a conversation as opposed to the kind of conversation that happens primarily in the media, which is argumentative or even filled with attack or cynicism, and that this opportunity to sit quietly and listen, and we have no internet discussion boards. We had full opportunity to do such a thing, and a lot of our work is based on that. But the only response to these essays is to write one of your own. And so I also want to introduce a couple more people just so you can see them. And if we go over to the restaurant together, then you'll know who they are, because they're very much a part of the making of this series. They're back here. I don't know if you'll be able to view them very well. The first is Vicki Merrick, who should stand up. And she's one of the people who gets up every morning along with Samantha Brown, who's sitting next to her, and sits down at the computer. And as they say, they feel like they should wash their hands before they go to work, because they encounter, as Murrow said, he said that this is like sharing your private mail with strangers. And indeed, that's what it is. They sit down to read the most non-trivial communication you can imagine, the core beliefs that guide someone's life, hundreds of them. We now have, as I say, we went on the air wondering what the response would be. We've got almost 20,000 essays have been sent. And, you know, it's a big number, I think, because we're not just asking people to say whether, you know, this singer or that singer was better and check a box, or even to write a sentence of opinion about Madonna's adoption. It's an enormous task. People have cursed us for planting the idea in their mind. The distillation, the kind of discarding of all the things you may believe, trying to figure out what you were taught to believe, what you think you should believe, what you would like others to believe you do believe, until you can strip down and actually say something real, something authentic. And it's amazing when you encounter those in the morning with your clean hands. So And there's one other person here who has contributed wonderfully to this book, and I urge you to look at it. He had an amazing challenge, and I hope maybe you can talk to him or he'll say something, which was to translate into image through the faces of people the thoughts that they expressed in words. That's Nubar Alexanian, a wonderful photographer. You know, and his in the middle of the book are his photographs. That's Norman Corwin, who wrote our first essay. And that's Jackie Lantry and her adopted son. And she's here tonight and we'll read that wonderful essay. I don't want to talk too much more because I want to listen. So I'll just read a little bit from the introduction and then you're going to I think you'll have a treat here tonight. Can you hear OK in the back there? Yes, no. Some people say yes, some people say no. Studs Terkel also wrote the foreword of this book, which is terrific. He wrote an essay for us, too. He was a little irritated that Norman Corwin, that he wasn't the oldest essayist. Norman Corwin is 96 and has him beat. Beliefs are choices. No one has authority over your personal beliefs. Your beliefs are in jeopardy only when you don't know what they are. Understanding your own beliefs and those of others comes through focused thought and discussion. Most public dialogue is now propelled by media outlets owned by a dwindling number of multinational corporations. A healthy democracy needs ways to bypass gatekeepers so we can communicate with one another directly and perhaps even find common ground. This, I believe, is an exercise in philosophical self-examination in a public context. It rises from the grassroots where people can begin to listen to each other one at a time. My own This I Believe essay begins, I believe in listening. This is no surprise, coming from one who works in radio and public radio at that. At the station in my hometown, it's our motto and the first word ever spoken on the air when we signed on, listen. If there is a testament to a belief in listening, it will be found in these essays. Take a moment then to consider the beliefs that guide the lives of others, beliefs that may confirm your own or challenge them, or even open your mind and heart to something new. And when you are done, think about this. What would you say? So we have a bunch of people who will read. And the first is Rick Reamer, Frederick Reamer. He was the first essayist from the flood that began to come in that we selected. He's a professor at Rhode Island College, and he will tell you other things that he is and that are contained in his essay. So this is Rick Reamer.
Good evening. If I can just seize the privilege of the podium for a moment. This, for me, was not just an ice sculpture. You know, what's wonderful about this series is that these things don't just melt away and disappear. They live on, and this is part of that. And the words that I wrote about a year and a half ago are not stale. They're still very fresh for me because, as you'll hear, this is part of what I do for a living in addition to my academic duties. And just 2 days ago, I was conducting a parole hearing at one of the state prisons in Rhode Island and thought very much about this essay because I was conducting a hearing for a woman who was an RN, past tense. She's now serving a prison sentence. She was providing home health care services and was skimming end pain medication from several of her patients to feed her own drug addiction. And in that parole hearing, I met this woman who was remarkably insightful about her own addiction, what led her to this heinous behavior. And that's reflected in my essay entitled The Real Consequences of Justice. Last Tuesday morning, I stared across the table at a woman with severe scars lining her otherwise gentle face. Her raging husband carved those scars and sliced off her ear when she told him she wanted a divorce. I'm a member of the Rhode Island Parole Board. Month after month, 13 years of months, I've met with criminals and victims. Immediately before my colleagues and I conduct parole hearings for the criminals, we meet with their victims if they wish to tell us their stories. Every time I walk into those hearing rooms, I retest my belief in justice. I do my best to balance my concern for public safety and my faith that some offenders truly have the ability to redeem themselves. And I can't ignore my wish to punish those criminals who willfully ruined another person's life. On hearing days, nearly always, the victims plead with us to keep the prisoner behind bars. All morning long, I hear their gut-wrenching stories of murder, rape, child molestation, armed robbery, and domestic violence. The victims return to their lives, which are often in shambles, and hours later I find myself face to face with the perpetrators. I settle in to hear what the prisoners have to say. Often, their stories are filled with regret, with hope, and lots of promises. These back-to-back encounters force me to confront what I really believe about people's fundamental rights. I am proud to be part of a system like ours, as imperfect as it is. The system does most of its work in the open and takes seriously the rights of both victims and the accused. But the truth is, I struggle to balance these clanging, colliding rights. Only an hour after meeting with the woman with the jagged scars on her face, I met with her offender. In his khaki inmate uniform, this monster explained with impressive insight and remorse how he had mishandled his failing marriage. The inmate showed me with heartfelt words the fruits of his hard emotional labor while in prison, what he had learned in treatment programs and from his own soul-searching. All of a sudden, he did not seem quite so monstrous. So how do I administer justice? I believe that justice cannot be shaped by simplistic formulas. Rather, justice happens when real human beings sort through a jumble of laws, rules, conflicting stories, and plain old instinct. Sitting there in front of me that morning was what justice is all about. The victim heaved and sobbed, fearing the prisoner's release. But both of us knew that the inmate would walk out of that prison someday. After all, the judge did not impose a life sentence. The question I had to answer was whether he would walk out the front gate on my watch. Administering justice is not theoretical. There are real consequences every time I answer the question, "What do I believe?" Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Most of the essays we get come into us written through the internet. There's an interesting thing for those of you that may want to write one, and I hope you'll consider it, whether you send it to us or just do it for yourself. A lot of people just do them, ask for them for birthdays and Christmas, and they've been read at weddings and funerals. There's so many things happening with this idea that we haven't organized. I'll tell you about some later, the way people have adopted it themselves. But there's a space for reflections underneath the where you paste your essay on the internet. And what's so interesting is so often people they'll say, "Oh God, I had to do like five drafts of this thing till I finally did what I did." But what I really wanted to say was, and then they write it again, and usually better. And I think that's the key, is that when they do that, when they step off the stage and talk, they get real. And I think there's a lesson for writers there, is, you know, you write the book and then write what you really wanted to say, and say it the way you do. One of our essays, most of them have come in that way. Some have come in by mail. Schools send them in, you know, handwritten, and we have to type them out and put them in our database. By the way, the whole thing is now online at thisibelieve.org, and you can search these 20,000 essays. You can find all the ones in your hometown, or all the ones written by kids, or all the ones about war. It's really a remarkable archive. We've got a University of Texas researcher has been doing. He's been putting it through his so-called meaning extractor. That pulls out narrative threads, and he's got fascinating data of what men write versus women, and what people write in different age groups and different regions, and so that'll be published eventually. But one of these essays came in on an audio cassette, and we listened to it. We happened to know the person who dropped it off because he lives near us in Cape Cod, and Vicky and I said, "This is unlike any other, and NPR will never take it." You have to imagine these things exist in this news context. You know, our editors, our news editors, I mean, it's really in some ways remarkable that this series exists at all for that reason. But to the credit, or what I perceive to be the credit of those editors, I finally, after waiting a long time, sent the audio down. I didn't send it in print. I said, just listen to this, you know. And the they took it. And we were astonished. And I think the writer, or reader, should I say, is here tonight. His name is Dennis Downey, and he lives down near us in Falmouth, Massachusetts, and came up. And sadly, is not in the book, because it came in after we went to press. If it were, you would see it's all uneven right-hand margin. It's appears on the page in a very unusual way. But you'll get to hear it right now. This is Dennis Downey.
When I do write anything, I talk it, and then I write it down. So it comes back out this way is good. I'll just say quickly that I grew up Irish Catholic, and I went to church every Sunday. And about by the time I was 15 or 16, I was kind of separating a little bit from it, but I had had all that church coming into me. And I started to read books about history and science, and when my own kids became were kids, I brought them back to Mass, and I would go there every Sunday with them so that they would get the same thing that I had. But this time I was listening and thinking about all the other things that I did know about the world. And so when this opportunity came up, this particular piece almost wrote itself in a way. I wrote notes for it, and then one day it was like a Shoemaker and the Elves situation. I just came back to the notes, and the piece was sitting there pretty much like this. I believe in genes and a forward flow of time, and in all things visible and invisible. Smaller than a light microscope sees, a gene is a genie, is a ghost, is one half of each of us given by one half of each parent. And each of us comes from two parents, each of whom came from two parents, each of whom came from two parents, in an endless crisscross of streams of time and persons going backwards. And each of us is as in our own incarnation, a soul inside a body, for some reason, a fire, a flame, a soul, what we desire, that we desire. The soul is the glow of us. The soul is the particular glow that the genes make when they make. Lighter than the flesh, it's the soul that stands the body up and gets it moving forward. Every body's soul is on a journey. And I believe we live in a solar system, that we go around a sun, the sun, and that a sun, the sun, is a giant ball of flame, fire on fire on fire. I believe that all of the energy, most of the energy for everything on Earth comes from the sun, except for the energies of the Earth itself, because the Earth itself is also on fire. Inside, in the center, at its core. We know this from volcanoes, that there's a fire going on inside of the earth. We stand on top of an earth that is a boiling ball of iron, on fire in space, spinning at its core as it circles a source of sunshine. And each generation is short, a mutation, from two, a new mixing of one, and then the same cycle of change, of climb and decline. First we're a child, then an adult, then a parent in turn to a child, then an old person, hopefully. With change, constant change all around us, always throughout. Who wears what? Who's in charge? What music sounds good? I believe that a book is a box, because a book carries something from some one person to another, and because it has been used and can be used to carry ideas across time, which is how ideas build up. And each of us is not only our own lives winding forward, but also a part of and in service to the larger life of the tribe, which in turn is in service to the larger life of the species, which in turn is in service to a larger life source lost in a bath of stars that is the galaxy scattered in the hugeness of the universe. We are not lost when we die. We never go away. Why would we go away? When we're gone, we come back. Thank you.
The So that appeared next to the economic reports of the day, interest rates. When we're gone, we come back. I hear a piano back here, and the next essayist, you know, so many of these essays, the people derive their beliefs from the simplest things. I mean, they're not they may not be, or even in Dennis's, perhaps the large things are the small things. But in many cases, these essays, the small things become the large things. And Mel Rusnoff, I was on the, if you listen to public radio, the radio show Open Source with Chris Lydon last night, and we called Mel to have her talk about her essay, and she's just sort of talked it through, and it's just so it's such a simple way to think about you know, a guiding principle, and it has to do with the piano, as you will hear. Mel's a civil engineer and drove up here from Connecticut, and you'll get to hear her right now.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. My involvement in this, I believe, has been wonderful, but it has created a big problem for me. A lot more people know that I play the piano now, and they all expect me to be really good. Well, if I were that good, I wouldn't be designing septic systems for a living. So I've been practicing like a nut, like I've never practiced in my life, and I'm getting pretty good. I believe in cultivating hidden talents buried and unrelated to what we do for a living. In ordinary life, I'm a civil engineer, and I make a satisfying, comfortable living working quietly in my cubicle. But in my other life, I am a pianist, bringing to life with my own hands the genius of Bach, Mozart, and Chopin. While earning my engineering degree, I worked as a waitress in the dining hall of a retirement community. And one day during a break, I discovered a piano in a meeting room. I sat down to play a few Bach two-part inventions. Those crisp driving rhythms and harmonics flew out into the hallways. Residents, numb from ceaseless, easy listening radio, tentatively peeked in, then sat to listen. Disbelieving, they saw plain old invisible Mel, the lunch waitress. She plays the piano. Where did you study? How long have you played? Can you play Rachmaninoff? They no longer wanted me to quickly and quietly disappear from their dining tables. Psst, Mel, wait a minute. Who do you think was better, Gould or Horowitz? I answered, Gould! And a raging debate ensued. For over 20 years, absorbed in my engineering career, I let my musical life die. But I was always reminded of it when I'd encounter the secret creative life of others. At a holiday concert, I heard a tenor voice so glorious it brought tears to my eyes. It was the sweetest, most touching performance of Silent Night I had ever heard. This masterful voice belonged to a colleague, Steve, with whom I had worked for years side by side in adjoining cubicles. I had narrowly defined him and so many others by their occupations. Since I had let myself get consumed by my job, too tired and spent for anything else, I assumed all other hardworking people had too. But Steve's artistry reminded me of my own hidden talent. I began to practice again and started taking lessons from an inspiring teacher who pressures me every week to keep at it, play better, get to that next higher level. One time, feeling bold and crazy, I should add, I played a Mozart sonata in an airport lobby between connecting flights. And I didn't play it very well either. It was terrible. But people slowed down and even stopped to listen. Readers looked up from their chairs. I saw smiles, and I heard a smattering of applause. I thought, no one smiled and clapped after my presentation on the site engineering for a new strip mall. I believe we are more than the inhabitants of our cubicles, more than engineers or even parents, husbands, and wives. I believe we are transformed and connected by the power and beauty of our creativity.
Mm-hmm. It's so great for me, and I bet Vicky and Newbar too, just to have all these people here who we've encountered only photographically or telephonically, and to see them and feel them, and it's...
We're all doing it in one take.
Yeah, I know. There's no editing here tonight. I should read Alan Lightman's bio, because he's a man of accomplishment. The book's arranged alphabetically. I like that. As Mel Rusnoff said, she's between Eleanor Roosevelt and Wallace Stegner. She feels like, feels kind of cozy. And we asked Alan to write for us. We invite a bunch of people to write. The thing is, we invite everybody to write. But some people we ask specifically, thinking that they might want to. And that people might want to hear from them. Many people turn us down. Many people say yes and don't do it. Some people say yes and aren't really able to get beyond either preaching to others or advertising themselves or doing PR for whatever it is they're involved with. It's hard to do. It's hard. We had a lot of trouble getting CEOs and politicians, for instance, to be real. And we've rejected essays from a lot of people whose names you know very well. That's a hard part of the job. Alan Lightman is an astrophysicist and novelist teaching at MIT. He is the author of Einstein's Dreams and A Sense of the Mysterious, Science and the Human Spirit. Lightman and his wife Jean started the Harpswell Foundation to help disadvantaged students in Cambodia obtain an education. And we're very pleased and honored that Alan's joined us here tonight.
Yesterday, my wife and I were in Stockbridge, Mass., and we went to the Norman Rockwell Museum, and we saw something like 360 covers of the Saturday Evening Post that Rockwell had gracefully illustrated, and we were struck at how much he captured the American spirit in those paintings. And I feel like this series does as well, and I'm very, very proud to be part of it. I believe in the power of the unknown. I believe that a sense of the unknown propels us in all of our creative activities, from science to art. When I was a child, after bedtime, I would often get out of my bed in my pajamas, go to the window, and stare out at the stars. I had so many questions. How far away were those tiny points of light? Did space go on forever and ever? Or was there some end to space, some giant edge? And if so, what lay beyond the edge? Another of my childhood questions, did time go on forever? I looked at pictures of my parents and grandparents and tried to imagine their parents and so on back through the generations, back and back through time. Looking out of my bedroom window into the vastness of space, time seemed to stretch forward and backward without end, engulfing me, engulfing my parents and great-grandparents, engulfing the entire history of Earth. Does time go on forever, or is there some beginning of time? And if so, what came before? When I grew up, I became a professional astrophysicist. Although I never answered any of these questions, they continued to challenge me, to haunt me, to drive me in my scientific research, to cause me to live on tuna fish and no sleep for days at a time while I was obsessed with a science problem. These same questions and questions like them challenge and haunt the leading scientist of today. Einstein once wrote, "The most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and true science." What did Einstein mean by the mysterious? I don't think that he meant that science is full of unpredictable or unknowable or supernatural forces. I think that he meant a sense of awe, a sense that there are things larger than us, that we don't have all the answers at this moment, a sense that we can stand right at the boundary between the known and unknown and gaze into that cavern and be exhilarated rather than frightened. Scientists are happy, of course, when they find answers to questions. But scientists are also happy when they become stuck, when they discover interesting questions that they can't answer, because that is when their imaginations and creativity are set on fire. That is when the greatest progress occurs. One of the holy grails in physics is to find the so-called theory of everything, the final theory that will encompass all the fundamental laws of nature. I, for one, hope that we never find that final theory. I hope that there are always things that we don't know about the physical world as well as about ourselves. I believe in the creative power of the unknown. I believe in the exhilaration of standing at the boundary between the known and the unknown. I believe in the unanswered questions of children.
I like how the essays are talking to each other. The vastness of time and generations and creativity and these themes and ideas running through, and each one expressed as uniquely as you can imagine. Einstein wrote an essay. It's in the book. It's that we've found now 1,000 essays from the 1950s on tape. We're having them all transcribed. They did also, they went overseas, the BBC did a series, and they did a series in Egypt, and there are 50 essays in Arabic that we're having translated. And we're hoping the next steps for this series, too, are to take it beyond our own borders. We're collaborating with the CBC in Canada, Radio Netherlands, and I'm hoping maybe Al Jazeera. I just got an email today from a group that's, schools have responded incredibly to this, and... there's a school in East Boston that's been having the kids working on them all semester. I'm going to go up and visit that class. There's an organization that gets prostitutes off the street in Nashville, and they had their big fundraiser with Nashville musicians last month, and all the women that they've helped came and read their This I Believe essays. They're amazing. We'll I want to select one of those for broadcast. But these are things that people are doing on their own. We're not provoking it. It's just happening. I forget where that sentence started, but there's Einstein. Is that mine? I hope not. We haven't been able to find the audio for Einstein's essay. There on our audio book, which is real. I recommend it to you. Because everybody appears in their own voice and they're back to back, so you get to hear the voice of Leonard Bernstein and Eleanor Roosevelt, and you can buy it in stores. I should mention that none of these essayists nobody's making any money. In Murrow's series, they paid $1 a pop, and for ours, we thought we should pay standard commentary rates for public radio, which is about $1.50. But everybody's agreed not to take any money, including Dan and myself. And if there are revenues, if books make money anymore, they would go back into the project to keep it going in whatever way we can. Also, I would also ask if any of you are major underwriters. To talk to me afterwards, and if public radio is important to you, then please make your pledge now in any amount you can afford. Einstein. So we haven't been able to find his audio. We had Robert Krulwich, NPR science reporter and a friend of ours, read it, and he did a wonderful job. It's the only one on the audiobook that isn't in the primary speaker's voice. But we do know the audio exists because Don Merwin, who is one of the surviving members of the original production team who sort of helped us get this thing going, thinking of, you know, describing to us the challenges they had. He was just out of college when he went to work for Ed Murrow. I guess he had, they had a team of fairly young people that were, you know, sort of had this dream job with the, you know, the icon of broadcasting then and now. So Don, a young kid, took this bulky reel-to-reel tape recorder over to Princeton to record Einstein. And Einstein evidently was fascinated with the workings of it and was saying, well, how does it, you know, what should explain this? And Merwin was saying, well, you know, it's magnetic tape. And there's a, and then all of a sudden he looked up and said, I'm lecturing Albert Einstein on electronics. I'll tell just one more little story. I think we'll finish up. We should go till about 8:30. Is that right? Does that seem about right? We've been traveling around with the book, going to a bunch of cities around the country, Dan and myself. I went to Ann Arbor, where we had a an essayist who was a 14-year-old kid with Asperger's syndrome who wrote a beautiful essay about respect for others and respect for difference. And his particular obsession, which he recognizes, is Godzilla. And he came to read with me, and he tends to read very, very fast. He would you know, in my effort, you know, I'm on the phone with the essayists, I'm really just trying to help them find their own voice, kind of get out of their own way. And with him, it was just trying to figure out how to kind of slow him down. Sometimes, so in the reading, he would sometimes speed up so fast he almost like ran off the road, and he'd have to just stop and regroup. But there was a moment in the essay when he heard his own words, which I think is when these things really come together and what we're sort of shooting for when we try to coach people. He heard his own mind, and he said, the line was something like, there's no reason for them to be so mean and cruel to me. And you could see him understand it and feel it. And it was just the whole room just was with him. And then afterward, his parents spoke, and they spoke about this. There's so many stories about just the act of doing this, how it's changed people's lives in their families. And in his family, the school treats him differently now. The kids treat him differently. His mother is so thrilled at ways he's grown. And his father, who came up to me afterwards, who's, they're working people. They weren't fancy. You know, I could tell he wanted to say what he did, which is that, you know, that the being with his son is so exhausting because he really will only talk about Godzilla, that he said, I got worn out on it. And he said, but I've realized in hearing him say this, that my job is to listen to him. And that's what I'm doing again now. So this was this fundamental change from this act of putting this down on paper. And then he got mail, so much mail. He had people writing, saying, you know, when I was in school, I made fun of kids like you, and I can't apologize to them, and I want to apologize to you. He had a postcard with him, which he read, which came, this is the wonderful thing about radio, you just don't know what kind of effect it'll have, what sort of accidental connection will be made. He spoke to this audience in the bookstore, and he said, do you know who Godzilla is? And they said, yeah. He said, well, I got a postcard from the world's foremost expert on Godzilla, who'd been listening in LA, and he wrote him a card, and he said you know, he's the one who imported the Godzilla movies, involved in the remake, and he said, you know, don't give up, stick with it, it's work for me. And uh, another essay that's gotten huge response, and it's just it's so simple and strong and real. Comes from Jackie Lantry of Rehoboth, Mass, who's here with us tonight, and I know you'll like hearing from Jackie because we sure did, and so did millions of other people.
How do I do this?
I'll do it. I'm a professional.
Thank you. My voice always shakes, so first of all, no notes. That's unbelievable, just unbelievable to me. And when I was little, I never thought, does time go on forever? I was like, where's the peanut butter? So I got to tell you, I drove to work on Mondays, and I listened to these essays, and I loved them, and I thought, I could never write anything like that. I mean, I really was. Where's the peanut butter? You know. And I heard somebody from Rhode Island, and you were a professor where I went to undergraduate school. And I thought, oh, it is real people. So I started to think about it, and I came up with I Believe in Love. And I thought, another silly lives, But I thought, why is that important, and why do you really truly believe it? And I thought about why. And I went home that night, 20 minutes on the computer, and I sent it off and thought, I'm done. I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. I wrote an essay for this, I believe. Whether they use it or not, who cares? I wrote it, So I get an email from Vicki Merrick. And I think, it's my rejection letter. And I'm reading it, and I said, these people are so nice. This is the nicest rejection letter. And I call my husband over. He goes, Jackie, I think they want to use it. And I was absolutely blown away. So a little bit of setup. My husband is an only child. We adopted 4 kids in 4 years, after 6 years of no kids. So, and I came from a family of 8, a big Irish Catholic family. So I'm thinking 4 kids will split the difference. It's perfect. 0, 8, 4, that's it. It was sort of like you said, 0, 8, 4, kind of in the middle. Anyway, so I went to get this little boy. We got a call one day, and it was from an adoption agency. We had adopted 2 kids, and they said, we're looking for somebody to adopt a little boy who's kind of sick, and we're calling everybody we know who's adopted. And if you know anyone, we want everyone to put the word out. So I said, well, we'll take him. And they said, yeah, you can't do that. You really need to talk to your husband. And I said, don't believe me, we'll take him. And she said, no, really, you need to talk to your husband. So I said, okay, let me call you back. I called Steve. I called the International Adoption Clinic at Rhode Island Hospital, the Hasbro Children's Hospital. I called a priest at the time, and within about 30 minutes, called her back and said, we'll take him. And I had her fax me the medical information. We faxed it to the adoption clinic. The physician said, we can cure it all. Don't worry about it. And, and it was rickets, tuberculosis, pigeon chest. The rickets, he had had such vitamin deficiencies that the weight of his body was bending his bones. Cleft lip, cleft palate. It kind of went on and on and on. So, I go and get him, and the first night I'm thinking, oh, my God, what did I do? It was awful. I didn't even call my husband because I thought, I've done it this time. But anyway, brings me to this. I believe in the ingredients of love, the elements from which it is made. I believe in love's humble, practical components and their combined power. We adopted Luke 5 years ago. The people from the orphanage dropped him off at our hotel room without even saying goodbye. He was nearly 6 years old, only 28 pounds, and his face was crisscrossed with scars. Clearly, he was terrified. What are his favorite things? I yelled. Noodles, they replied as the elevator door shut. Luke kicked and screamed. I stood between him and the door to keep him from bolting. His cries were anguished, animal-like. He had never seen a mirror, and he tried to escape by running through one. I wound my arms around him so he couldn't hit or kick. After an hour and a half, he finally fell asleep, exhausted. I called room service. They delivered every noodle dish on the menu. Luke woke up, looked at me, and started sobbing again. I handed him chopsticks and pointed at the food. He stopped crying, and he started to eat. He ate until I was sure he'd be sick. That night, we went for a walk. Delighted at the moon, he pantomimed, "What is it?" "The moon. It's the moon." He reached up and tried to touch it. He cried again when I tried to give him a bath until I started to play with the water. By the end of his bath, the room was soaked and he was giggling. I lotioned him up, powdered him down, and clothed him in soft PJs. We read the book, One Yellow Lion. He loved looking at the colorful pictures and turning the pages. By the end of the night, he was saying, "One Yellow Lion." He had never heard English. And I turned to the last page, and he looked at me and said, "One Yellow Lion." It was amazing. The next day, we met orphanage officials to do paperwork. Luke was on my lap as they filed into the room. He looked at them and wrapped my arms tightly around his waist. He was a sad, shy boy for a long time after those first days. He cried easily and withdrew at the slightest provocation. He hid food in pillowcases and foraged in garbage cans. I wondered then if he would ever get over the wounds of neglect that the orphanage had beaten into him. It has been 5 years. Luke is a smart, funny, happy fifth grader. He's loaded with charm and a natural athlete. His teachers say he's well-behaved and works very hard. Our neighbor, who doesn't know any of his story, says she's never seen a happier kid. When I think back, I'm amazed at what transformed this abused, terrified little creature. It was not therapy, counselors, or medications. It did not cost money, require connections, or great privilege. It was love. Just simple, plain, easy to give. Love is primal. It's comprised of compassion, care, security, and a leap of faith. I believe in the power of love to transform. I believe in the power of love to heal.
Well, I think maybe what this series has proved to us that work on it and maybe to those who listen to it is that we're not as divided as maybe as we think we are. And whether we're from red states or blue states or one religion or another and one color or another. I get to read a few words of Edward R. Murrow. These were some of the words that made us feel as if we ought to revisit this idea, and you'll understand that it is that they are prescient, maybe. I mean, as contemporary as they were, they are contemporary now. We hardly need to be reminded that we are living in an age of confusion. A lot of us have traded in our beliefs for bitterness and cynicism, or for a heavy package of despair, or even a quivering portion of hysteria. Opinions can be picked up cheap in the marketplace, while such commodities as courage and fortitude and faith are in alarmingly short supply. It has become more difficult than ever to distinguish black from white, good from evil, right from wrong. What truths can a human being afford to furnish the cluttered, nervous room of his mind with when he has no real idea how long a lease he has on the future? It is to try to meet the challenge of such questions that we have prepared these broadcasts. Thank you.
podcasts, author interviews, and book reviews, visit www.bookbrainspodcasts.com.